Ladies and gentlemen, from the golden microphone of the EIB, it's El Rushbo, reminding you that unless I'm trapped in a drug-addled hillbilly heroin haze, I never listen to the promise of tomorrow. And now, liberal alert, here comes the colonel.
Okay, enough of that. Go back to your own show. All right, welcome back. The second half hour, The Promise of Tomorrow. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to wrap it up with Dr. Aidan Ogen, the associate professor leading the Bio and Nanophotonics Laboratory at the Electrical Engineering and Bioengineering Departments at UCLA, and the astounding work that he's doing in the field with diagnosing diseases just using his iPhone. And then, Dr. Ray Bachman's going to stop in, our old friend, who is director of the Nanotechnology Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas, and he's going to give us an update on artificial muscles. And, of course, at the end of the program, the listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, here's our fountain of useless information. Throw in the coins here and get an answer to today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Ah, yes, once again, the spirit of the fountain has responded when we threw in the coins. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, here is another one for you, a real stumper. Ha, ha, ha. Along the lines of who's buried in Grant's tomb. Well, tell me, oh, spirit of the fountain, what was King George VI's first name? The first name of King George VI, what was it?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the others.
Ooh, can never seem to fool the spirit of the fountain. The first name of King George VI? Well, King George VI's first name was Albert. When he came to the throne in 1936, he respected the wish of Queen Victoria that no future king should ever be called Albert. That was her husband's name. All right, on with our program. Okay, back to Dr. Aidan Ogen, who was explaining to us when we broke about how all the things that can be done in the lab with the diagnostic equipment can now be done in the field using iPhones.
Different parts of the spectrum, optics, terahertz, X-ray, acoustics, we will see more and more useful technologies that are centered around the use of computation, for bringing in more megapixels, more gigapixels that are quite useful in terms of what they can show in tiny details in terms of time or space of the specimen that they're looking at. And I also personally think this computational imaging direction, which is very exciting these days, has a lot to do with the cell phone. It's very much connected to it because the cell phone creates the roads, the highways, for translating these ideas to practical implementations, even in resource-poor settings. And that's the connection that I've been highlighting for optics. I'm sure other researchers are going to be doing the same thing for other parts of the spectrum. For ultrasound, there's also a great opportunity. But I believe this merge of the use of computation and the use of cell phones for bringing in new technologies, new theories to practical implementations, spatially around the cell phone, will open up new applications, will open up new technologies that will aid spatially biomedical researchers and medical professionals.
Oh, wow, that is so, so exciting. And you gave us a really nice look into the future. And I'd like to have you go a little bit further. Do you see a time when through nanotechnology and through these tools that you're describing of us now that we're going to be able to erase diseases entirely because we catch them early and we can manipulate them and turn them back into to substances, if you will, or particles or something that will not be a disease to man or beast? What do you see there? And if you do see that, how far down the road before we're going to be able to have this kind of control of disease?
I think that's the holy grail of telemedicine in general, trying to capture things at a very early stage where they become extremely easy to manage, extremely easy to treat. And they try to make this even for the most deadly diseases like cancer. So in that regard, I think early diagnosis, relevant and accurate diagnosis through more useful information, more useful tests. Sometimes it's an image, sometimes it's not an image, it's essentially a marker that you're trying to detect and quantify, or sometimes it's a panel of markers that you're trying to quantify. And sometimes it's the sequence of your genome that we're trying to look for hints about your future health. So I think that's the revolution that we are going to see in different dimensions. Imaging is only a tiny part of that big revolution that we're going to see, where technologies, heavily digital, heavily computational, will help us find patterns, assign statistical probabilities of certain diseases, and which will shape our, hopefully, our lives in terms of our lifestyle, our diets, our exercise needs, and our potentially treatment needs much earlier than conditions become severe. It's also going to be extremely cost-effective for healthcare in general, because chronic disease management, unfortunately, is a huge burden for developed countries, including the United States. So chronic patient management is going to get worse and worse because we are aging as a population. We're going to increase the lifespan of people in developed countries to reach routinely hundreds in the next decade or so, which will mean we will have to monitor chronic diseases more severely, and we will have to spend more money. In that regard, home monitoring through telemedicine technologies would be extremely important for management of those aging populations and catching conditions that would be much more severe, much more difficult to treat or act. And those, I think, are opportunities where digital technologies at the home, at the point of care office, would be quite powerful in helping us tap into these symptoms, these conditions, and make meaningful predictions out of them.
Well, Dr. Ogin, this is fascinating. We're going to look forward to seeing you at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, the IEEE Conference, going on to the San Jose Airport Garden Hotel in California. For those listening that want more information on that, go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, and on the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link which will tell you all about the conference. In the meantime, we really look forward to seeing you at that particular conference, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having, and I also look forward to attending the IEEE conference in the fall.
Next, we want to dial up our old friend, Dr. Ray Bachman, director of the Nanotech Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas, and get an update on his pioneering work in artificial muscles.
Stand by.
Hello?
Hello. Is this the famous Ray Bachman?
Is this the famous colonel?
Ray, it's so good to talk to you again. My God, it's been so long. I've got to catch up with you.
Yeah, it's good to always to talk to you, too. What I can tell you about is work that we published on textiles that harvest energy, store energy, and use energy.
Textiles with sensors in it that harvest and store energy, that these are the clothing that we wear?
Yes. Very interesting to have clothing that responds to the environment to open and close porosity so that a wearer's comfort is increased. If the temperature is too high, then the porosity of the textile should increase so the person can cool down.
Now, wait. What you're talking about is if we put on our clothing, we go out in the daytime, and it gets really warm, and so then the clothing kind of opens up and lets the air breathe through, and then a cold front moves in, and it automatically closes up so that it warms us more. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, uh-huh. We've actually made these textiles that effectively breathe, and we can make them using a type of yarn that we described in an article in Science this year called our hybrid carbon nanotube yarns.
Mm-hmm.
These yarns are artificial muscles that are wonderfully strong, can respond very, very fast, can do 80 times provide 80 times more higher power output than the natural muscles. Wonderful. Okay, now we use these hybrid yarns for example, in optical devices and in, you know, prototypes of toys, but and also in microfluidic valves and rotors. These are the types of things we've demonstrated or are demonstrating. But one of the most exciting application areas is to weave these yarns into textiles, and they can undergo dimensional changes of over 35%, which is about the same as the contraction of natural muscle. But since they're a yarn woven into a textile, we can use these yarns to open and close textile porosity. Now, what is the nature of these hybrid yarns?
Yeah,
well,
right.
What we do, it's just a carbon nanotube yarn, which
okay.
we spin by a special process that we described long ago in an article in Science.
Mm.
And this is by, we draw these yarns containing nanotubes from what's called a nanotube forest. This is a arrangement of nanotubes, which is like a bamboo forest. Individual nanotubes are perpendicular to a growth substrate, like the trees in a bamboo forest.
Okay.
When we pull one nanotube from this forest, that nanotube pulls another, who pulls another, and eventually you end up with a carbon nanotube sheet. What we do is we take those sheets, twist spin them in the yarn into a yarn, and that twist spinning is just like has been used for undoubtedly over 100,000 years by humankind. Well, yeah, humankind or close relatives to make ropes. You know, when you take grass and twist it to make a yarn.
All right, so you're doing the same thing with carbon nanotubes, is what you're saying.
We're doing the same thing. However, the fibers in our yarns are at a vastly smaller dimensional scale in terms of diameter than for conventional fibers technology. And in fact, for every pound of yarn, you'd have to spin about 4 billion miles of carbon nanotube.
Oh, wow. Ooh. That's incredible, Ray. Wow.
Now, the way we make or change these yarns into high-performance muscles that can operate without the need for containment, like in electrochemical muscles that we previously looked at and developed, you got to put the yarns inside an electrolyte. In other words, a salt solution.
Okay.
And have a counter electrode. In that case, the real weight of your muscle is not just the weight of the carbon nanotube yarn, it's the weight of the whole system, which could be much larger than the weight of the muscle. In our new muscles, these hybrid muscles, what we've done is eliminate the need for electrolyte. Our muscle is just the yarn with a guest material inside it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we eliminate the degradation that can arise from the use of electrolytes. We eliminate the weight penalty associated with these electrolytes, in other words, these salt solutions. We eliminate the need for a counter electrode. And we eliminate rate responses that you associated with electrochemical artificial muscles. We can drive these, switch these muscles very, very fast. They can provide output power that's about 85 times higher than for a natural muscle. You can spin a paddle up to about over 10,000 revolutions per minute.
Wow.
And spin it up in one direction, and then reverse this direction, and do that 20 times a second and still have an average paddle rotation rate of over 10,000 revolutions per minute.
All right. Well, now these are kind of the outgrowth of the, what we talked about before in the program, the artificial muscles and the things that you're doing with that. And now you're using the same type of science that you developed the artificial muscles to make these textiles that will expand and contract and will open up and breathe and then and close back up again. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think previously, I don't think I talked to you about our newest muscles. I think the previous muscles I talked to you about were the electrochemical. Maybe I'm wrong. Do you remember which muscles I talked to you about in the past?
I remember the you were, we were talking, first of all, we were talking about the external muscles that, that were operated by a an apparatus that that would allow a person to do extra strength, but it was kind of contained on the outside. And then we graduated to artificial muscles where a person really had more control of it, built right into his body as a unit. And I wonder if that's where we're going with this.
Each year we have another breakthrough on artificial muscles that are not electrochemical, that have wax, that could have paraffin wax infiltrated into them. Could these muscles be deployed inside the human body? Certainly that is a very long-term prospect. We are not replacing the natural muscle. However, we are there's a possibility of replacing the function of natural muscle. For example, the function in pumping blood throughout the body, the function of the human heart, other functions that involve mechanical activity inside the body is, for example, in the medical area. Smart pills are of great interest. Now, these smart pills that, for example, may have a camera associated with them and may go down the intestines and inspect the intestines, and sometimes even make repairs on the intestines or other parts of the body. You need a method of propelling these smart pills or other type of miniature mobile robotic devices inside the body, and our muscles provides one possibility for providing this type of mobility.
Okay, so right now, though, what we're really talking about is the artificial muscles woven into textiles that would expand and contract with the weather and the temperature. Is that right?
Yes. Use the sensing capability to provide a muscle response and deploy this muscle response for a useful purpose. A good example for the hydrogen area is what we did is took our carbon nanotube yarns, used a special process which we call bi-scrolling in order to put palladium particles in the corridors of this yarn.
Okay.
Now, when we expose the yarn to hydrogen gas, the yarn contracts.
Okay.
And that contraction can open a valve. When the hydrogen concentration goes down, the yarn expands, and the valve closes.
All right. Well, I'm getting the picture here now a little bit, and again, getting back to the clothing of it, I guess it could be responsive to temperature of the human skin. You might use it inside, you know, wetsuits or something like that, with divers in the ocean where the temperature can vary pretty rapidly, or maybe even in traveling in areas of outer space or the stratosphere where the temperatures can vary pretty rapidly. Is that kind of some of the things you have in mind too?
Your comments are appropriately targeted. We can't do this for a practical sense right now, but it may be feasible in the future to make textiles that sense the existence of a biological agent that might be used against a soldier and close porosity.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So it could be used in warfare too to prevent toxic gases or something like that from getting to the skin. Is that what you mean?
That or biological agents. But this is, again, is more futuristic. We can make textiles if we expose them to different chemicals. They'll contract. But providing this response on a time scale needed to protect the soldier, that is a challenge. But on a easier, lower hanging fruit is, again, smart textiles that change porosity with change in temperature. Another thing is some garments, for example, spacesuits, are very difficult to get into because they must be very tight.
Yeah.
So we could use our artificial muscles to expand the spacesuit, and allow the astronaut can get into it, and then we can contract it. Now, some people like to wear garments that are pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this ability to adjust by actuation the dimensions of the garment and then switch them to a tighter configuration can be easily deployed.
Oh, so somebody that wanted to be really modest in a certain situation could wear baggy clothing, and then when she goes out to some place where she wants to look really attractive and sexy, should the clothing can all contract around and you can see her curves. Are you saying that too?
Yes, that's certainly feasible.
Oh, this is getting more exciting all the time, Ray.
Then, of course, for heating the textile. When the textile is very tight, the person wearing the clothing might be hot in more than one way.
Oh, I see what you're saying. All right, that sounds like fun. Well, the remarkable things that you are doing with artificial muscles, we've been following this along, and here's a nice new stride. And this has been just fascinatingly interesting. I hope you will update us as you're doing these things. You're going to come back again sometime and give me another call so you get something for us.
Sounds good. I always enjoy talking to you.
Well, Ray, you're very kind. Thank you so much for being with us. We really do appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Especially in North America, that if people can seek the opportunity to live for a little while without electricity, to develop their skills and their understanding around a life that's not made so easy by turning on a switch or by having all of our needs met by electricity, just to have that experience can really help contrast how much power we're actually consuming, and it provides for a wonderful educational experience and gives us a sort of sense of our place in the world and maybe a chance to compare our lives with lives of others in countries where electricity is so scarce. Sheila Kerr, part owner and director of sales and marketing at Windstream Power, based in North Ferrisburg, Vermont.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you. I